everybody. Welcome back to the Aleheads Podcast. I'm your host / six-pack, and with me tonight is our very first pro brewer guest who was on the show way back in the summer of 2011, Jason Lavery of Lavery Brewing. How you doing, Jason?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing very well tonight. I think the last time we talked to you, you were getting ready to move into the new physical plant of your brewery. You were still purchasing equipment, and I mean, it's been kind of a whirlwind since then. Can you give us a little bit of a recap of what's been going on since that point?
Yeah, I think we talked in August 2011, maybe.
And yeah, I think so.
We finally got all our licenses figured out in September of 2011, so you talked to me when I was ready to pull all my hair out probably at that point. But yeah, we finally got licensed and expanded to Philadelphia, New Jersey in the spring and summer of 2012. Added some new tanks at the end of last year. Last year we did about 350 barrels, so we're still a tiny brewery. Now in 2013, with the additional tanks that we have online, we'll do about 1,000 barrels this year. And now our big project right now is opening our pub, so we're projected to open. It's like a glorified tasting room, you know, has seating for about 40 people with a full kitchen. We're going to have eight of our beers on draft, and we're projecting, hoping that to be open, like I said, August of 2013. So, again, you talk to me when I'm ready to pull my hair out. So,
just like clockwork, or maybe you're always ready to pull your hair out.
You know, I'm wondering.
So, okay, so you've got a 10-barrel system, and how much fermentation capacity do you have?
Now we have 30 barrels of fermentation, and we have 20 barrels of bright tank capacity, and an ever-growing amount of oak barrels. We have some tequila barrels now and some rum barrels, and then our eight bourbon barrels that we use every year.
Right. How much space does the physical plant of the brewery actually have at this point? Are you starting to bump into things, or do you have still a little bit of room to move out?
No, somehow the brewery ended up being laid out really well. We'd been in enough breweries in our lives. We knew what we wanted and what we didn't want. So it's a, you know, it's not luxurious, you know, space by any means, but it's not a cramped brewery as of yet. You know, we have about 3,500 square feet in the brewery, and a lot of it still is walkable, and, you know, we're not to the point of squeezing between tanks or anything like that. We have a lot of room for growth in the brewery we're at. We can fit 11 tanks in there. So right now we have the five tanks. So we still have a decent amount of growth to do. And at that point, if we ever do get to that point of having all those tanks in there, we'll have to deal with warehouse issues about, you know, where to keep the grain and the empty kegs and the bottles and yada, yada, yada. So the brewery itself is about 3,500 square feet, and the pub, which is directly next to the brewery, is about 1,500 square feet. So our whole space is about 5,000 square feet.
So the pub you're talking about as a glorified tasting room, is that partly because of the way the Pennsylvania laws are in terms of being able to sell pints within your brewery? You also have to have food?
No, I call it a glorified tasting room because our focus has always been on the beer, and the food for us is a means to an end. I mean, I even wrote it. I've been working on our employee handbook, and I spent, you know, a page and a half talking about, you know, the devotion and the dedication we put into the process of making beer, and then I put about a half a paragraph into food, and all I said was it's local whenever possible, and it complements the beer perfectly. So we're trying to get our employees to get in that same, you know, mind frame, a frame of mind that, you know, people are coming there for the beer. We don't expect very much, you know, to-go business for lunches and things like that, you know.
Right.
So I call it a glorified tasting room, but, you know, it's a full-blown pub.
And when are you looking at opening that?
We told all our contractors August 2nd, so
wow.
We're working on that. We got our licenses all figured out already, so that's ahead of the game, and it's funded already, which is nice. So we're way leaps and bounds better off than we were when we opened our brewery 3 years ago.
Yeah, I would say so. And what do you, how would you explain the success in being able to grow so quickly? Is it the packaging and sending it out to different markets? Is it what you're able to do just within Erie itself?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think Yeah, I don't think our growth's been too fast. I've been trying. I mean, obviously it's been fast growth just because we're so young. So every year, you know, we're kind of, you know, in 2010 when we got our first license, we were doing an alternating proprietorship. 2011, we moved into our own brewery. 2012, we added tanks. 2013, we got the tanks fully online. So it's like every year there's been, you know, just natural kind of increases in capacity.
Right.
I don't think we'll have a big increase in barrelage between 2013 and 2014. I think our brewing process is, we're really nailing that down. And I think the reason for our success is, you know, we're creative and we're craft beer geeks, just like everybody else. And we're passionate about our product. And, you know, any reason that any good brewery is successful, I guess, you know. We came out with an IPA in October of 2012 that's been gangbusters for us. It's called Dulacan IPA. And we started putting that in 12-ounce cans.
I'm drinking one right now, actually.
Oh, yeah, you like it?
I'm very pleased with it. I've been looking forward to being able to support a local IPA, especially a canned IPA, because I just like the package format. And nobody in Pittsburgh has really kind of taken on that mantle and filled that niche. And so when I saw that you were looking to do it, especially, you know, I'd had other beers of yours that I really enjoyed. I've been drinking quite a bit of it over the past couple of weeks. So what's the reception been like with that beer?
It's been crazy. It's been really good for us. I told you, you know, we didn't do a lot of barrage last year, and this year we've already done 200 barrels of just Dulacan so far, you know, and it's just June. So I think that's going to be, it's going to be our de facto flagship for the brewery. We've always kind of resisted against making an IPA. That lame kind of excuse that, you know, oh, there's so many good IPAs out there, why not, you know, you can drink somebody
right.
else's. We actually fell into that beer. The whole story was Sam Adams, you know, they contract hops just like everybody else does, and last year, at the end of last year, they had about, I want to say they had like 2,000 pounds of some really nice hops that they weren't going to use, so they offered them up to the craft beer community on a lottery basis. So I put our name in for 88 pounds of Simcoe and 88 pounds of Citra.
Nice.
Not really expecting to get anything and not really having
yeah.
beer to brew with them. So sure enough, you know, like 2 weeks later, without even kind of any confirmation, the you know, hops just show up on our loading dock. So we're like, wow, we better make a beer with these, I guess, you know. So we did a little 5-gallon test batch just to make sure that the hops played together. And then we added, what did we add? We didn't add Mosaic at first. It was Simcoe, Citra, and Columbus. And then eventually we got rid of the Citra because we ran out of it, and we bought more Simcoe. I bought like 3 times as much Simcoe and added a little Mosaic, and that's the Dulacan you're drinking right now. So now we got really nice contracts with lots of Simcoe, Citra, Amarillo, Mosaic, really nice hops. So we're in the IPA game for sure.
And those are the big IPA hops right now. And how big of a struggle is it to get those contracts? I mean, that was one of the conversations we had when we had talked before. I remember your Imperial Red, which was your sort of de facto flagship at that point. You had sort of built up a really nice recipe. You were really happy with the product, I think. And then, you know, something happened and you weren't able to secure the hops for it. So you had to, I think maybe it was Amarillo that you were having trouble getting, so you had to play around with the recipe, and that was something that you were stressing about the last time we talked. I mean,
yeah.
I guess there's probably always something that's stressful when you're running a brewery, but so you feel like you can produce the Dulacan in basically its same state for the foreseeable future?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and the good news of that story is that we started brewing, we got Amarillo back in our contract for brew year 2013, so Imperial Red this year has had the full dose of Amarillo in it, so it's kind of back to its original way that it was. So that's the first part of what you're talking about. And then the second part was, yeah, we have hop contracts all the way through 2016. I think it's
wow.
just kind of a natural, I don't know if a lot of the industry is going through it. I know a lot of the young guys are having a hard time securing hops, just like we had a hard time securing hops. And I don't know if that's the hop brokerages not really wanting to give contracts to new breweries, kind of favoring the little more established breweries. But, I mean, I signed contracts, like I said, for 2015 and 2016. It was so easy. I mean, I've never had an easier experience in my life. I said, I want this many pounds of this Simcoe, this many pounds of Citra. And they said, okay. And they signed on the dotted line, you know. And
I'll sign a hop contract.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and we said internally in the brewery, I said, you know, I'm not really worried about over-contracting for Simcoe or Citra or Amarillo or Mosaic or Falcon or Slate because there's always going to be a market for those, you know, if we do end up buying excess quantities. So, I mean, the hop freezer at the brewery is it's awe-inspiring to home brewers. So, because it's the good ones, you know. We never, when we made the IPA, we never really wanted to make like an English style IPA or anything like that. If we were going to do it, it was going to go the way we like to drink IPAs, which is like Pliny the Elder, Headhunter from Fatheads,
sure,
or Kern Double River or Double Citra. So, I think we did well, you know.
It's interesting that there's Mosaic in this, because that's sort of the new hot hop that a lot of people are experimenting with. I think it just even got its designation as Mosaic, I think, last year.
Yeah, it was like HB 369 up until then.
Mm-hmm, something like that.
Yeah.
And it does have a nice sort of rich round. It almost has like a little melon taste to it, I think. And I don't know. I think it works well. Great Lakes used it in their Alchemy Hour this spring.
Delicious. Did you? Yeah.
That was so good.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see what all the pros are going to do with that going forward, because that's, you know, relatively new.
Yeah. Speaking of hops, you know, interesting experience. Last week we had our first ever hop salesperson come to the brewery. So maybe we are moving up in the world that we have hop salesmen coming to, you know, give us samples and things like that. He was giving us some experimental hops with no names yet that he was letting us rub and smell. And you can buy these, you know, and be the first brewery to make them famous or, you know, or whatever. So.
Sounds like a weed dealer or something.
Yeah, right.
First one's free.
Some of them smelled amazing. There was one, I can't even remember the call numbers. It was just, I think, 5 digits. It's had a amazing, like, black currant, kind of the darker fruit smells to it. But then it still had that, like, American quality. It's kind of hard to explain. But, yeah.
There's money in finding the next. I mean, I wonder who sort of backs these things. I mean, obviously Citra is one that's just exploded, and Mosaic's the next one. And there's, like you said, there's a bunch of ones we've never heard of with weird call numbers and these salesmen walking around and it's like sort of shady briefcases being like, this is the next great IPA hop. But I mean, there's definitely money in it because they can't grow them fast enough. And the new variations, you know, people get attached to that certain flavor, and it's like what you talked about with the Imperial Red. You can't replicate it by just mixing other hops together. You don't get the same effect.
Yeah, definitely not. There's no there's no remedy for. You can't replace Simcoe. You know, you can't replace Amarillo. You can't replace Mosaic or Citra. You know, go ahead.
No, so what were you saying?
I was going to say, we found a good way to replace Centennial in the brewery. That was the only one we really found a replication for, just a little bit of mix matching. But now we got Centennial, too. We actually have so much Centennial, we're going to have to sell some this year, which is, like I was saying earlier, a unique situation for us.
Yeah, you talk about yourself as a young brewery, and you definitely are, but I feel like you sort of got in just on the cusp of where you needed to in order to sort of build up a following and be established. I think as many breweries and planning as there are right now, I think it's really hard for, unless you're in an area that's sort of remote that doesn't have any craft breweries. I think that, you know, home brewers that are going to try and look to scale up, even if they do have a little funding, are going to find an uphill battle. I mean, it's like what you talk about. You're able to get your hop contracts. You've got the salesman coming by. You know, you've got this sort of social proof that people like your beer and people want to support you at this point. I wouldn't want to be starting a brewery right now.
No. Yeah, well, some of our friends are in Erie. And,
really?
Yeah, it's brutal to watch the progress. You know, just the things they kind of have to cut and just because of lack of funding now and the amount that equipment increased since when we bought our setup, and we paid for our setup in February 2011. And I feel like that was kind of a little bit before everything kind of exploded, because I know what we paid for our stuff is, you know, at least double now, the same setup.
Really?
10-barrel brew house. So,
double?
Yeah, I mean, because we bought ours used, and there is no used market anymore. I mean, you might as well buy a 10-barrel, and that's kind of the, you know, the little, the tiny, I mean, that's the system size that is medium range for everybody, you know, unless you're going nano
yeah.
or something. So everybody's looking at 10 barrels. So there's no used 10 barrel stuff on the market. You might as well buy a brand new 10 barrel brew house or fermenters, which is what, you know, as we are maturing as a brewery, we find like the tanks we bought last fall were brand new. We'll never be back in the used market again, thank God. So, but yeah, I feel like we were a little bit ahead of it, which has been good. I mean, it's been a steep learning curve, but I'm really happy with where our brewery is and where we're going and our lineup of beers. We're adding about 3 new beers every year, so we're still keeping that creative flair in the brewery. We did a Black Saison this year, did another IPA called Alphabet Stew. It was a collaboration with a brewery in Pittsburgh called Full Pint.
Full Pint, sure.
Yeah.
Was that for Pittsburgh Beer Week?
Kind of was. It wasn't one of the official Pittsburgh Craft Beer Weeks, but we brewed it in late March to be released during Pittsburgh Craft Beer Week, just because Full Pint's native to Pittsburgh and we're close enough that we want to be Pittsburgh natives. So you know, it was kind of camaraderie that breweries have.
And it was a market that really embraced you. I mean, that I heard about you guys relatively early because people in Pittsburgh were talking about you. And at that point, I think there were only probably just a handful of cases coming down every couple weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
And now I tend to, a lot of the better beer bars, I tend to see your stuff on tap pretty frequently. And I think with the Dulacon cans, it's just sort of exploded. I don't think you can probably make enough of it to satisfy just the demand for it in this market. That's my impression.
That's the reality we're facing that we've never really experienced before. It's because there is a finite amount of those hops, no matter how big our contracts are. So, I mean, we are going to stop brewing Dulacon probably in August this year, which our wholesalers, you know, are not going to enjoy, but, you know, there's not really much we can do. So it's going to be
right.
It's a flagship in a sense because it's very popular and it's a majority of our barrelage. But on the other sense, you know, January to August is a pretty good run for a seasonal. So
yeah,
so it'll be back in January again with the exact same hops and malt profile.
Because that's when the contracts kick in again and you're going to be able to secure those.
Yeah. I mean, the harvest is usually August, September, and our hop contracts
yeah.
are usually for brew year, so January 1st to December 31st. So January 1st, I can order my contracted hops right back and get them in the brewery as soon as they can.
You know, though, it's not such a bad thing for a beer to go away for a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
it's sort of the model has always been, we grew up drinking beer. You could all, if you had a favorite beer, you'd be able to get it all year long or something like that. But even something like Fathead's Headhunter, which I think is one of the best IPAs I've ever had, there's a certain amount of fatigue that happens. And I see old Headhunters sitting on shelves, not because it isn't great, but just because that's the economics of it. I mean, if it's available all year round, people assume they can get it all the time, and then it's not that same value proposition. I mean, I think it's almost a blessing for this beer. I mean, I'm enjoying the hell out of it right now, but let it go away for a few months, and then when the new fresh batches are ready in January, February, whatever, you know, people will be clamoring for it again.
Yeah, it worked out great because we've never really been a big flagship brewery. We've always focused on seasonals, and I think that kind of absence makes your heart go fonder. You know, we get emails all the time about people asking us when we're going to release, you know, Belfast or Devil Bird or Imperial French or whatever the beer is. So there's, you know, like the anticipation of looking forward to it. Not that we want to create like a Dark Lord Day kind of environment, because that's
right.
fun and all that kind of stuff, but it's a little bit over the top for our sensibilities and our brewery. But yeah, I like that. You don't ever get the chance to take it for granted. That's a good way to put it.
that's true. Exactly. So you said that you've got you've been releasing new beers every year. Is there anything that's on the horizon for 2013 that we haven't seen before?
We did a beer called Death or Glory. That's still around in the markets of just Erie and Pittsburgh. That's kind of been our new. We call them one-offs in the brewery when we're working on the new beer. You know, we do a pilot batch to make sure it tastes good, the recipe-wise, and then tweak that. And then usually we release a beer draft only. The first release of a one-off is draft only, and usually just goes to Erie and Pittsburgh. So we did a blast right. on, man, we must have released it in May, I want to say, maybe early May. So the Black Saison.
I had it a couple weeks ago in Piper's Pub.
Did you?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah.
That's an unusual beer for them to put on at Piper's. Usually they're all, Englishy, European.
They're fans of yours there, believe
me. Oh, yeah, those guys are absolutely amazing, yeah. Hart and Andrew, yeah. So we did that beer, and that beer turned out really well. We're bringing back the Alphabet Stew, actually. We just decided that this week that we're going to try to make that a, because the DualCon's going to be running out, and we have a bunch of other really nice hops that can make a nice IPA that are not DualCon, you know, they're not like the Simcoe Amarillo hops. So we're going to make Alphabet Stew again, which is ran through the gamut of some of the newer hops, Apollo, Bravo, Delta, and Centennial. So we're going to make that IPA again here in the fall once DualCon ends.
Okay.
And
are you
going
to can that again, or is that going to just go draft only?
No, that'll be bottles only.
Bottles.
Yeah, bottles and draft. So, we've got a lot of increase in our... Go ahead.
What was your experience like? We were emailing, setting up this conversation, and you said that you'd you'd used the a mobile canning operation to can the DualCon. How did that experience go? How'd you hook up with those guys?
It was good. We did by the end of it, we'll do 12 batches with them. So they're based at Danville, Pennsylvania, which is close to Williamsport, I'm told. I don't know exactly where. So they would drive in usually the night before. We would have the beer all, you know, fined and carbonated and clarified and ready to go, and it was cold. So they would drive in and set up their little two-head canner and basically do it themselves. We kind of stood around and supervised. Our brewery's not big enough that you can, you know, do other tasks while something like that's going on. I guess when they go to some other breweries, you know, the breweries will brew while they're canning, but we would pretty much stand around and supervise, and we would do about 110 cases in about 6 hours, usually give or take, depending on how well the beer was flowing, if it was foamy or not. And then they would clean up, we'd write them a check, and they'd come back the next week. So it's been interesting. It's not really that high tech of a canner, but the quality is good.
I've been impressed with, I mean, I haven't had any bad cans. I haven't had any sort of carbonation issues. I bought a case of it a couple weeks ago, and I'm almost through it, and I haven't seen any variation. So, in terms of my anecdotal kind of, you know, viewpoint, it seems like it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. And the beer's been going so fast, we haven't really had a chance to find out, you know, what the shelf life is like, because everybody's been, you know, selling out. Erie, which is a fairly smaller market, you know, in Pittsburgh, obviously, has been going through almost 70 cases a week, which is crazy, you know. I have 4 cans at the brewery, and we just did 110 cases last Wednesday, and we sold them all out. Over the
I've got more than you do.
I'm like, man, I can't even find out how this beer holds up, you know. I'm like, boy, I hope there wasn't a problem.
Well, I guess if it sells that fast, then there's no problem.
Yeah, so, I agree.
I've even seen on Twitter, you know, people in Philadelphia during Philadelphia Beer Week, you know, tweeting pictures of it like it was a bottle of Pliny or something like that. Like, look what I found. I got the, you know, like.
We did send beer there.
Cool.
People were harassing me on Twitter about sending DualCon to Philadelphia, and I'm like, I promise, I sent 3 pallets of it to Philadelphia. It's just such a big city that, you know, it gets lost so fast. Sold out,
you do it during beer week, too, and it's just, you know, it's going to get
convenient. Philadelphia, specifically Prohibition Tap Room, is the one that kind of, I feel like, catapulted DualCon to any sort of, you know, recognition. They were one of the first ones to put it on and kind of rant about it and telling everybody to drink it, you know, and then it started slowly from there. You feel like you always need a bar in a city that's passionate about your beer, like Piper's and Carson Street Deli in Pittsburgh were the first ones.
Carson Street, he loves you so much. And like every time I talk to him, he's like, oh, Lavery tasting it. Oh, Lavery's coming up. Or Lavery. I'm sorry. I always say... I've been saying Lavery for 2 years ever since I talked to you, and I was just perusing the website, and I realized it's Lavery.
That's fine. Everybody says Lavery. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Prohibition Pub was all about it, you know, and they were pushing it around a lot. And so because of that, there's our sales reps out there started selling it to other bars, and next thing you know, I'm sending, you know, tons and tons of Dulacon to Philadelphia, and then Erie and Pittsburgh kind of got wind of it, and that was that. So this was like fall 2012, so
yeah,
fall, early spring, and then it got so popular, and we were like, hey, we should probably package this in something other than a keg. Well, that was then the can came about. Synopsis of the whole history of Dulacon.
So what's the next seasonal that we should look for?
Imperial French is coming out in July. It was released
That's a
here
good one.
It was released here in Erie this Monday. So
okay.
That was the 24th. July, or Pittsburgh's getting it July 1st. So that beer came out really, really good this year, really well.
Have you been tweaking that recipe, or is it pretty much the same as when that was a beer that was well established even to the point when we had talked a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we haven't changed the recipe for that at all. Last year we used Warrior in the hop profile, but we cut the Warrior out this year and replaced it with Chinook, which is how it was originally when we first brewed it in 2011. So it's kind of back to the 2011 recipe. So that just got rated. Draft Magazine just gave it a 96 in their current issue, which we got while we were in Philly for Philly Beer Week in the beginning of June, which is pretty good for us because that's the highest we've ever had a beer get ranked by a sort of national publication like that. So that we were actually at Monk's eating lunch that day, Monk's Cafe. And I was like, oh, it's going to be the best day ever. I'm in Philly for Philly Beer Week. You know, Draft Magazine just rated one of my beers really highly. And I'm drinking Pliny the Elder at Monk's Cafe. So, so
good day.
Yeah. And so we're going to be releasing the Imperial French here soon. And then we actually just got tequila barrels and Caribbean rum barrels that are 30 years old into the brewery last week. So we brewed another batch of Imperial French Ale, which generally we only do like 20 barrels of like Devil Bird or Imperial French, just because they're so expensive to make that we kind of, you know, just keep it high demand, low supply. So we actually brewed a third batch of Imperial French that's going to be going in tequila barrels and rum barrels for a year that we're just going to sit on and see how that ages.
See what happens.
Yeah, we were racking our brain for a beer to put in. You know, I kind of bought the tequila barrels without even thinking about what would go in them. The rum barrel, I figured we could put something in them, but then he offered me tequila barrels, and I said, sold. You know, and then we got them, and I'm like, man, what do you put in tequila barrels? I don't even like tequila.
Exactly. I've been thinking about that. I read an article on Beer Pulse last week that the Oscar Blues Gubna, which is the single hop Imperial IPA that they do with, I think it's Summit Hops, and it's a very divisive beer anyway, and then they're going to be putting it in tequila barrels, and one of my friends just does not like Gubna at all. He hates that hop and doesn't like tequila either. I'm like, this sounds like the worst beer in the world for you. He's like, actually, I would definitely try it. I mean, who wouldn't try it? I've never had a tequila barrel aged beer, so
yeah.
I can't imagine what the French ale is going to taste like out of that. So
I thought the light whiskey or the light spirit, whatever you want to call it. The only thing we've ever really done is bourbon barrel aged, so it's so predictable how it's going to taste. All I could put my head in, you know. Imperial French, we kind of call it a Belgian barley wine, which is kind of what it is, with American hops. So then when I said it that way, I was like, oh, that sounds good, tequila, you know. So we'll see how it goes.
Truly international beer.
Yeah, right. I think you'll see more tequila barrels in. I know the brokerage of barrels we use based out of Denver, Rocky Mountain Barrel Company. They have a lot of contacts in the craft beer industry, and I know Voodoo Brewing Company in Meadville just bought some of the tequila barrels as well, which was not a collaboration at all, you know. Kind of found out, he's like, oh, shit, you bought those too? And I'm like, oh, shit, you bought those too? So I think you might see tequila barrels flood the market here a little bit, so.
Well, it'll be interesting.
Yeah,
I've started to see gin barrels here and there. I mean, bourbon, it's almost like bourbon barrel beer is passe, which is kind of sad considering how long it takes to, you know, to age it and some of the challenges that go into getting good beer out of it. But I mean, we're still in the experimentation phase, clearly. And
right. our bourbon barrels are going to be pretty much spent soon, and we don't really have plans to buy anymore. So we're going to
really.
We've been wanting to do a sour program since we started the brewery, and it's always been a question of, you know, space, and we need to pump beer out so fast. There's so much orders. You know, like when I was telling the canning guys, they were trying to, they're like, hey, let me grab one of those cans off the line just to quality control. And I was like, no, you cannot. I was like, this beer has been sold 6 times pretty much is like the demand, you know. Mm. If you want a Duolicon, I'll get you like a sample out of the taps, but the cans are so pre-sold. So, you know, the breweries had such great orders coming in that we never really had a chance to play around with the sour beers like we always wanted to. So,
right.
When finally the Devil Bird gets out of them for this year, we're going to hopefully put a sour brown, which we did a pilot batch of, which was pretty much Imperial Red Ale base without all the hops, and then just soured with some Roselair strain of yeast from Belgium, and it turned out really, really well.
Nice.
People were drinking growlers of it, which I thought was a little excessive for how acidic it was. But
I hate it when people are excessive with your beer.
So
it's like the highest compliment you can get as a brewer. You're like, I don't think you should be drinking that much of that beer.
Yeah. We have a guy comes in and fills, because our Imperial French is on tap at the brewery, and there's a guy that has a gallon growler, and he'll come in and fill a gallon of Imperial French, which is $15 a regular growler, so he's paying
right.
$30 to fill a growler of this, and he'll drink it in like a night, and I'm like, I just feel like...
Ouch.
Yeah.
And what is that, 12%?
11.5, yeah. This year is about 11.8, actually, so...
Didn't it used to be... Wasn't it 13 at some point? I remember.
No, it's already been... It's always hovered around 11.
Okay. Well, you know, the guy likes it.
Yeah.
You can't fault him for that.
I don't mind, yeah. I think at some point in the pub, we're going to have to limit, just kind of get into the logistics of limiting sales of beers like that.
Yeah. I don't know
if you limit it to... I'm definitely going to say no growler fills of Imperial French at our pub, just because, you know, just like I said to you earlier, we only do so many batches of it, and sad if people can't get a pint of it because some guy got a gallon of it earlier, you know.
Every day.
Yeah, well, not every day. Like, once a... Yeah. He hasn't come in yet this year, but he was doing that last year, so...
Well, yeah, you were talking about, you know, Dark Lord Day. I mean, you can easily see how... Some of these beers, especially when they go away for a whole year, pick up a following, and people, you know, find out about stuff like this on social media and want to show up and get as much of it as they can because they know they can drink a lot of it, give some to their friends, trade it, all the kind of stuff that beer geeks are wont to do.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit before we started recording about the Stingy Jack. Mm-hmm. And is the name's going to change for that this year?
Yeah, there's a winery in Massachusetts that has a trademark to it. There's a few other breweries in the country that make Stingy Jacks, Pumpkin Ale, one being Laurel Wood in
right.
say Oregon. But so this winery in Massachusetts, you know, has the trademark to it, and they basically sent us a cease and desist, and so we went to our lawyer and. He recommended a trademark attorney here in Erie for us, and we talked to him, and he said basically, you know, beer and wine are distinct industries, and there's been precedents, you know, I guess there's a Blue Moon Winery, and they sued the Blue Moon, they sued Coors, saying, you know, you stole our trademark, Blue Moon Winery is ours, and the judge ended up saying that no, a five-year-old knows the difference between beer and wine, that they're two different industries completely. So our lawyer basically said, you know, we could fight it and most likely yeah. we would win. But the way trademark law is if we lose, we have to pay the legal fees associated with both sides of the case, which would be a hefty, hefty bill. So
sure.
we decided to just let it go. So now it's going to be called the Devil's Pumpkin Ale.
And is it actually going to come out in the fall, or is it going to debut in sort of late July like all these other pumpkin ales you want to do?
Funny you mention that. No, we've always stuck to our guns that we released Stingy Jack on Labor Day. So Labor Day is really early this year. It's I want to say it's like September 2nd. So,
yeah.
Yeah, we will start brewing it here early August, I want to say, and kind of stockpile a bit of it and then get it out to the markets closest to us so they can be released that Monday, Labor Day.
Nice. Are you looking at moving into any new markets,
No, we're done.
or
Yeah.
just you're doing Pittsburgh, you do Philadelphia, you talked about New Jersey a little bit, obviously Erie. Just trying to keep enough beer in those markets is keeping you busy.
Yeah, New Jersey's been great for us. We've been there about 9 months, I want to say. And they're all bottles. They don't get any draft, and they've been going through a decent amount of beer for us, so it's been really good. And then
And you do all large format bottles at this point
yeah,
still?
22s and 750s, and Dulacon is our first 12-ounce package, but New Jersey hasn't actually gotten any of that, and they won't this year at least. So, and then Lancaster slash York has been huge for us this year. They have a really dedicated craft sales team, our wholesaler Ace Beer down there. So, they've been pushing lots and lots of our beer. So yeah, between
Nice.
Erie, Pittsburgh, Lancaster, Philly, and New Jersey, that's about all the farther we want to go, and kind of just start focusing on, they call it going thick, trying to pick up more accounts in the towns we already are, and focus on that. And with the pub, we don't have a lot of beer to send around, and I can't just magically make tanks appear. So with the limited amount of beer we can brew, we want to make sure we keep all of our markets stocked as well as the pub. So it's almost like we're adding a new account in the sense that the pub's gonna be eating a significant amount of our beer. So it's gonna be an interesting logistical nightmare for me.
Well, I'm sure you'll be up to the task, and maybe
Yeah.
we can talk again in a year or two and see if you're still pulling out your hair. Last question. I wanted to talk about I saw a recent announcement. There's a small company here in Pittsburgh that has started to do brewery tours, and I think it's PA Brew Tours or PA Beer Tours, something like that.
Right.
And they're doing their first overnight session. I think they're going to start out in Pittsburgh, hit a couple beer bars. They're going to go to Voodoo, and I think they're going to end up and spend the night in Erie and hit Lavery, I'm sorry.
Very nice.
And how did you get hooked up with them? And have you seen within your sort of tasting room model, have you seen people that are starting to visit Erie just in terms of tourism because they want to try your beer?
Yeah, we've been doing growler hours at the brewery on Saturdays since January 2012, and every Saturday we get groups in from, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Buffalo, as far as away as, Williamsport, Pennsylvania, or West Virginia, Rochester, that come to the brewery that, we're part of their loop of tours that they're visiting, because in Erie there's three breweries within, a mile radius of each other. So the only three breweries in the city are, pretty much on the same street together. So their plans are usually, to swing by and hit all three breweries. And then they either go up to like Southern Tier at Ellicottville, or else they head south to, Voodoo, Sprague's, Blue Canoe, Timber Creek, those breweries down there. So, yeah, the PA Brew Tours, he just contacted us a decent amount of time ago and asked if we were open to it, and we said yes. And then I saw on his site that we were on his list, and then a day later he called me and he said, "Hey, can we plan to stay?" And I said, "Well, it looks like you already did, so sounds good to me." So I think it's
I
August
guess
10th.
that's a pretty easy sell. I mean, I'm gonna bring a bunch of thirsty tourists through who are gonna buy a bunch of your beer and swag and whatever else, and then they're
Oh
gonna
yeah,
leave.
and I
We'll even
love it. I
drive
mean,
them.
that's something that I'm still real passionate about. We try to go to as many of the festivals as we can, just because I never gets old talking about beer, honestly. So having a group of, I think he said he can fit like 40 people on his bus or something like that, kind of blow through the brewery, and they're all beer geeks because, they paid money to go on a brewery tour. So yeah, I think his name's I think he's somehow associated with Voodoo Brewing Company. Jake, the guy that runs the PA Brew Tours.
That's possible. I've talked to some of the guys that sort of work with him, but I haven't met him yet. But it seems like most of his tour is doing pretty well. They do, I think, like basically a tour a week down here. It's mostly the Pittsburgh, like they do the Saints and Sinners, where they'll hit Helltown and All Saints, which is sort of out east, and they'll do the Penn and the Full Pint and East End and all that stuff. But they're getting a little bit more. A little bit more you know, setting their stakes out a little bit farther. And with Voodoo right on the way, and you've got Erie and Brewery and then you guys up there, it's kind of a no-brainer. So I'll be curious to see how they do in terms of selling out that tour. I didn't know they had, if they could take 40 people, that would be quite a party.
Yeah. I'm not sure the number he told me, but it was a decent sized bus that they bring up. So yeah, I'm excited. Anything to help the industry, you know, and that definitely will.
All right. Well, Jason, thanks for giving us a little bit of catch up about some of the trials and tribulations and some of the successes. And it sounds like the brewery is really going gangbusters.
Yeah, we're having a blast. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Absolutely. So we'll talk with you soon. I'll raise a glass of Dualcon to you and everybody there at the brewery. So how do people, if they want to check out Lavery, what's your Twitter handle there?
Lavery Brewing.
Lavery Brewing.
One word.
And then LaveryBrewing.com. You can find out all about their beers and figure out how you can stop by in Erie and try a little bit. So, anything else before we go?
No, that's everything.
Okay, awesome. For Jason Lavery of Lavery Brewing, this has been Slouch Six Pack saying good night and good drunk.